The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia Online. I'm Andy Cahan, Director of Author Events. I wish that when I went to college, we had an intellectual history that was as erudite, witty, and entertaining to read as Sarah Bakewell's latest bestseller, Humanly Possible, 700 Years of Humanist Freethinking, Inquiry, and Hope. Sarah's other books include At the Existentialist Cafe, which was named one of 2016's best books by the New York Times. She is also the author of How to Live a Life of Montaigne, a National Book Critics Circle Award winning biography of the great essayist. She formerly worked as a curator of early printed books at the esteemed Wellcome Library for the History of Medicine, earned a postgraduate degree in artificial intelligence, and taught creative writing at London City University. Tonight, she'll be in conversation with Eric Banks, director of the New York Institute for the Humanities at New York Public Library, and consulting editor of the forthcoming Robert Rauschenberg catalog Raisiné. And Eric was a former senior editor of Art Forum from 2003 to 2008. Sarah, Eric, it's great to have you with us. The screen is yours.
Thank you. Thank you, Andy. I want to
thank you for the kind invitation
to join you today. And I want to thank the Free Library of Philadelphia for hosting us for me this afternoon, for Sarah this evening. Sarah, it is really wonderful to see you again. It's been a number of years since we last saw each other in person. I'm very happy to be able to speak with you this afternoon. My happiness is only slightly dimmed by the fact that we're doing it through these screens, but you know, that's life in this century. So I was very excited to see that Sarah had a new book on its way. I had actually been thinking a couple of months ago, I wonder what Sarah's working on, and we were going to hear from her again and see her in print. I knew that there was something coming. Like I imagine many of you joining us today, my introduction to Sarah's extraordinary work was a little over a decade ago with her book, How to Live, or A Life of Montaigne in One Question and 20 Attempts at an Answer, which was a remarkable work of biography and a tremendous work also in which Sarah puts so much of herself into the writing of the book. And it's a charming, great book. It's one of those books, they're rare that you actually can count the number of people you recommended the book to. And I often had this experience of talking about the book and someone saying, "Oh, I gifted that to this other person." So that was just a mark of how incredible I think that book was. A couple of years ago, she also published At the Existentialist Cafe, Freedom Being an Apricot Cocktails, which the last part of that title is also, I think, gives you a sense about how Sarah explores extremely difficult, recondite topics and philosophers, some very serious thought that she's able to write about in a way that I find unique. So I was really excited to see the title of her book, the first part, Humanly Possible, and say, hooray, we have a new book from Sarah Bakewell coming. And then I saw the subtitle, 700 Years of Humanist Freethinking, Inquiry, and Hope. And I thought, my God, how long is this book going to be? This has got to be seven volumes. It has to be like one of those Mortimer Adler projects. And of course, it's wonderfully told. It covers a lot of territory. It's an extremely capacious book. I've so enjoyed spending time with it. I'm really happy to be able to see you today, Sarah, and have the opportunity to talk to you about it. I thought I would just start by asking you just a little bit about the genesis of the project. How did this book come into being, and um, how did you wrestle with the manuscript over time? I mean, for covering seven centuries is quite impressive.
Well, yeah, I mean, like you, I thought at one point that it was going to be seven volumes and that kind of, and then I set myself to a lot of deleting and a lot of really tough, being tough with myself to try and get it down to shape. So, but it was a passion project. It was something that brought together things that I'd been interested in for so many years. I mean, the genesis of it really was I sort of reflected on things that I'd been writing about with previous books, a lot of the things that I read about and I'm interested in. And I realized that they all had in common this being part of a humanist tradition, not necessarily the same part of the humanist tradition, because that's a very widely varied, capacious thing. And, you know, the existentialists were part of it in a very different way from how Montaigne was a part of it. Mm-hmm. So, that was my feeling. It's like, I want to explore what all these things have in common, find out what this humanist tradition can be. And it was something that was also personal to me, because I'd gradually come to start thinking of myself as a humanist. Like a lot of people, I think I was a humanist for a long time, without realizing or without using the label. And so all of that I wanted to explore. So it was really, you know, it was certainly a project that was both personal and also very intellectually challenging and interesting for me to research.
Yeah. Well, I want to talk to you in a little bit about the process of writing the book, which I want to do sort of toward the end. But I did want to, you know, note that like another capacious book, Moby Dick, your opening sentence or question is, in your case, is three words long, that sentence. And it is, what is humanism? So I think that it's a term that certainly there are many different ways of thinking about what we mean when we talk about humanism. And it may be a question that I would think that the reader would come to this book just asking, basically, what do you mean by humanism? And you start this first chapter giving us an example of the many different ways that one can think about the word.
Yeah, I mean, it definitely, you know, it's a question that comes as soon as you use the word humanism. Me too. You know, it's like, what do I mean by humanism? And I think a lot of people feel that way. So in the book, I approach that by stealing something from another writer, basically, by telling a story that I picked up from a comic novelist. So that question, what is humanism, is a quotation actually from that book. So it's the scenario is told in a comic novel called Second from Last in the Sack Race by David Nobbs, English comic novelist, humanist, better known for a book called The Fall and Rise of Reginald Perrin, which became quite well known over here because it was made into a TV series many years ago. Anyway, this book, it's kind of this part of it, he's basing it on his own memories, I think. And he tells a story of students at a school, at a high school, I guess, and they decide to set up a humanist society. So they all get together, have a meeting, and that's immediately the question that comes up right from the start. What is humanism anyway? So that's their question. And then one of them says, well, humanism is the Renaissance's attempt to escape from the Middle Ages and to, you know, sort of start all over again with an intellectual revival. Then somebody else says, but humanism is, I thought humanism was the attempt to get away from supernatural ideas of reality, to get away from religious ideas and look for other sources of the meaning and dignity of the human being. But then somebody else says, but that's weird, because some people do have religious faith, but they still call themselves humanists. So, you know, that can't be right. And then another person says, but I thought it was just being kind, being nice to people and looking after old people and sick animals and things. to which somebody else says, no, that's humanitarianism rather than humanism. And yet another person gets completely fed up at that point and says, this is just wasting time. And to which the humanitarian one says, do you call being nice to old people and looking after sick animals a waste of time?
Yeah.
So the whole thing like falls apart, and they just, you know, they can hardly get off the ground with this humanist meeting. But for me, that was my starting point was, the thing is, they're all right. Like, each of those people are giving an interpretation of humanism, which is perfectly valid. So, okay, there's like five different definitions that are offered in that meeting, but it doesn't have to lead to chaos and sort of giving up. The question that then comes to my mind is, well, what do all those things have in common? So you've got like your Renaissance humanists, who are literary scholars, teachers of the humanities. We still call them humanities today, you know, still call them humanists, those who specialize in it. You've got your kind of non-religious humanists, religious humanists. You know, there's a definite sort of, they're completely different ideas of what humanism is, but they're all valid. And an idea of a moral way of being and a sort of philosophical humanism. And all of them are different facets of this varied idea, but they all, I thought, what do they have in common? What they have in common is right there in the word human. They all take the human realm of culture, society, and relationships and morality, moral relationships with each other and with the world of life of which we're a part, and you know, history in the case of the scholarly type, you're sort of talking about human culture that is being recovered and read and written about. It's they take the human realm and make that the starting point, make that the thing that they want to investigate, as opposed to, so there's this kind of classic division into three realms. That there's the divine realm, which is studied by theology. There's the physical realm, which is studied by what now we call the sciences. And then there's the human realm, which is the realm of history, ethics, sociology, politics, all the things that humans distinctively do in our social world. And that's what all these forms of humanism are kind of making a foundation and a starting point. So that became my foundation and starting point as well. I thought, I want to find out what all these things, what connections there are, and how they responded to each other, and how the idea of humanism has developed through these different meanings.
Yeah, and these four strands that you just outlined, they frequently don't, we don't frequently think of them as coming together. But one of the things that I like about that, about the way you approach the question and how you open it up, is that it's I think a very humanist way to understand it. It's not dogmatic. It's not a question of, this is actually what we mean by this and these other things.
In terms of my response to the question.
Yeah.
I mean, that, and I take as my kind of motto in doing that the words of a very noted humanist, E.M. Forster, the novelist, who's said only connect. He put that into his novel Howard's End and used it as a kind of epigraph to the book, as well as using it in the story itself. Only connect. You know, what he meant by it is sort of, let's connect ideas to one another, connect ourselves and other people, connect our actions and their consequences, so that it has all this realm of meanings. But he, that for me became my sort of principle, find the connections, explore the connections, for connections. And it is very much a humanist approach, because he also sort of wonderfully, at one point when he was asked, what do you mean by humanism? What does humanism mean to you? And he said, well, you know, it's hard to define. It's almost best defined by listing all the people that you've ever liked or loved or been friends with, and all the art and literature that you've enjoyed, all the things that you've loved. You know, that's the definition of humanism. So that's a very personal very humanistic way of talking about humanism.
Which I think is one of the great things about the book. I mean, I'm not going to give away this ending. There's a beautiful ending that you have, or a near ending, where you list all these things that we've just encountered in the book. And most of them are really specific things. They don't give themselves to systematizing, to abstraction, et cetera. It's not a creed. It's not a dogma. It's not a fully worked out system, but it exists in that same way that Forster talks about listing the things that you love and the things that have meaning for you and the things that you value, and they're individuals. It's not a listicle, but it's but you get this sense of it's almost a kind of anti-heroic way to approach that motto, which animates his, not just Room with a View, where it first appears, but Passage to India, many of his novels, Room with a View, and then, you know, his posthumously published novel Maurice. So he's such a great figure to ground the book in, and also that motto, Only Connect, really is serves as such a great foundation for the book. I wanted to ask you about, I originally was thinking about a couple of quotations that you highlight in that in the opening, and that was one of them. And the other one I was thinking of that I wanted to ask you about, that provides you with your title, is one from the Roman playwright Terence.
Yes.
And I'll read it in English, not in Latin. I am human and consider nothing human alien to me.
Yeah. This has been, in a way, it's the same idea, Only Connect. It's that we're all connected through our humanity. So I'm human, therefore I'm sort of bound and connected and tied to other human beings that are around me in my life, or that I might encounter. We're bound to each other sort of from the start. We're not isolated beings. The lovely thing about that quote, which has been, since it was sort of first appeared in a play, it's been quoted by humanist organizations and, individual sort of enthusiasts for humanism for centuries. Montaigne had it. It was in pride of place among the various quotations from his favorite authors that he had literally painted into the beams on the ceiling of his study. That had pride of place. The interesting, or that what kind of amuses me, is that in the original play, it's actually just a kind of gag. It's a joke. It's a comic line. So you've got one character saying to another, why are you always being so nosy? It's a nosy neighbor that he's talking to, and the nosy neighbor says, I'm human, nothing nothing human is alien to me. It's like he's saying, what can I do, I'm only human, or I'm human, I'm interested in what my neighbors are getting up to. So it's in there for a laugh, but it's taken on this life of its own. And I think it's a very resonant quote, especially when you think about people who are suffering, people who are, sort of connected to the suffering of others. Mm-hmm. And Terence would have known something of what he was talking about there, I think, because he was enslaved. He was an enslaved man in Rome. His part of his name is Afer, which means African, although he may have been, we don't know, he probably was of Roman origin, but perhaps grew up in Carthage. I mean, all this is a little bit of speculation there. But anyway, he was taken in as an enslaved, as a boy, as a young man, as an enslaved person, and began writing, sort of was given a kind of freedom by the person who had enslaved him, perhaps because he liked his writing. But you certainly get a very strong sense that that Terence, in talking about humanity and our shared humanity and that kind of human essence and dignity that we all have, it means a lot coming from someone who's been through that experience.
It definitely does. And I think the afterlife of both quotes, but particularly the line from Terence, will come to animate a good bit of your book. There are so many stories that you tell, and there are so many different, I mean, it's not stories that you tell, but there are so many stories that run and threads that run through the book. And in the remaining time, I'm sure we'll cover all of them. Now, I want to point out just a few and discuss them. And I think I want to start with the fact that one of the stories really that runs through the book is it's a book about books, and it's a book about frequently unpublished books. It's about how the circulation of manuscripts, often by hand, goes hand in hand with the development of the idea of what it means to be human and the kind of consolidation of the idea of humanism. And you begin with Petrarch and his wonderful acquaintance or irascible acquaintance of Boccaccio in the 1300s. And you have this wonderful quote from him about the way that he addresses himself to the spirits of the past. And addresses them from the land of the living. There's a way that the past really comes alive. These books take on an almost lifelike quality for Petrarch, and they become so important to the early manifestation of the humanists. I'd love for you to say something about the, you know, also talk so much about the importance of Petrarch, how important writing, like physically writing, was for him. There's a way that it's almost like you feel that writing was invented at that moment. Obviously it wasn't, but
I wouldn't go that far, but I think what was distinctive about Petrarch, and the reason why I decided to start there, I mean, there's an introductory chapter which sets a much larger context, both geographically, culturally, and historically, in the sense it goes back a lot further than 700 years, but then when I sort of, you know, get into the 700 years, I start with Petrarch largely because, so he was a poet, book collector, manuscript collector, editor, all-round scholar, sort of humanist for hire, in a way, because he worked for patrons, either in the church or outside. He had a very powerful vision himself of what he felt he was doing with all of this, and he saw himself as reaching back into the whatever he could recover of the classical culture, especially the Roman culture. Writers like Cicero and Virgil, who were two of his favorites, so the sort of Roman authors, and whatever he could get hold of, basically. He longed to read Greek, but he never really learned it. Very few people did in Western Europe at that time. Mm-hmm. So he saw himself as bringing all of this sort of from a time of light that he thought it existed in the ancient world, across what he defined as a period of darkness. And the whole idea of the Dark Ages really starts with him. He looked back on the time since the fall of the Western Roman Empire to his own time and saw just like this awful darkness in which texts were lost and wisdom was lost and moral sort of revival was needed. He saw himself as sort of bringing these things to life again for a new time. So it's this kind of self-mythologizing, I suppose, that really made him feel like a good place to start. But, you know, the genuine love that he had for those authors and for the manuscripts that he managed to find. So he kind of traveled around Europe, especially the Italian peninsula and France, as it now is, to sort of try and find manuscripts wherever he could. He'd stop at any monastery in particular and ask to look through their forgotten rooms where, you know, he might find something, mm-hmm. at which point he might acquire it. But quite often he would have to stop and copy it. So he's if he was traveling with friends, the reports of, you know, they'd have to stop and wait for days on end while he sat there copying out a manuscript in its entirety, because that was the only option, no printing yet, of course. And so he accumulated these, he worked on them, he edited them, he shared them with friends, and he built up a huge network of friends, of whom Boccaccio was one. There were many, many others. And he wrote letters to them all, and then collected his own letters into a compilation, which is a wonderful rich resource. I mean, it just opens up that whole world that he lived in, but it also gives you a really strong sense of his personality. Mm-hmm. And some of those letters he addressed to the likes of Cicero, And those are the ones that he wrote from the land of the living. And he would talk to the ancient authors, but not always in a reverential way, even though he admired them so much. He'd sort of scold them for you know, sometimes making bad decisions and, you know, they could have done better. So it's this wonderful sense. Again, Only Connect comes up there too, because it's this sense of connection with the authors of the past, all mediated through study, through the humanities. I mean, that's absolutely where I think the heart of it lies, is the idea of, you know, making through the cultural, what's left, what can be revived, what can be found, sort of, you know, finding a new life. So, yeah.
And that's that's very much of what's at the spirit of the book. I mean, there's this, if there's a figure, it's probably Janice that I would think of as that very much of the project here. It's looking forward and looking forward and looking back at the same moment. And a kind of timelessness that is still embedded in this, you know, incredibly rich and deep history. And you mentioned, you know, just to stick with that moment a little bit longer, because this is also a way to think about the past and the present and the future together. We approach a book like this now when we have so many questions about and real fears about our, you know, our own future and the future of the human. I'm struck by how many moments or punctuate your book of great disaster, of terrible catastrophe. At the time, one of the experiences I had a couple of years ago that was incredibly meaningful was to lead a reading group of Boccaccio during the early days of COVID, when we really didn't know what our own future would look like. And that great story of a group of 10 people leaving Florence to escape the plague and spending the days passing the days spending telling stories to one another. But you know, you talk, and many people have written about the great earthquake in Lisbon and 1755, which was such an earth-shattering, literally, experience for writers. Is very
It really shook everybody up. Yeah,
it really did. But you know, I mean, from Voltaire to Goethe, and it's really interesting to see. I mean, it also, to me, points to this strand that you write about as well when you explore what the meaning of anti-humanism is. But I do find that really interesting, the way that this sort of coexists, and you know, in some kind of great tension, and can often be the goad for these moments of which we think of as really the beginning of the Enlightenment, for example.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a sense of, in responding to crises, you know, they're reflecting on what's important in human life, and that can take various forms. So with Petrarch, I think, again, I had a strong feeling that after the, of course, 1348 was the height of it, the first great outbreak of plague in Western Europe, followed by many other outbreaks through the ensuing decades. So he lost many, many friends. And this sense of loss, so part of this wanting to recover and find a sort of source of renewal, I think it didn't start with the plague, because he was already well into it by then, but it was the desire to sort of preserve things, to find these precious things and hold on to them, and also to preserve and advance his friendships, and you know, sort of, that's what writing is. It preserves human life, parts of human life, against the inevitable loss that comes with time. Jumping ahead to Voltaire, of course, very different time, very different context, but when he responded to this Lisbon earthquake, he was sort of looking more to the future in a way, because his response was, the first one was a sort of a poem that he wrote in the immediate wake of it, about it, just imagining the terrible suffering of the people who were caught up in this, the earthquake, the fires that followed, the tidal waves that swept people away, the horrible aftermath with the buildings having, you know, been shattered, and people trying to piece together their lives amid the ruins and disease and all the things that followed. So, you know, his first reaction was just imagining that suffering. And then most famously in Candide, but also in other works, he started to write about rejecting the response to such disasters that says, well, you know, we must just accept it because this is clearly God's plan for the world. So the famous idea that was codified but didn't start with Leibniz, the philosopher, that all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds, because, mm-hmm. you know, this is the way God made the world. He clearly, you know, this is optimal. It couldn't be better. This must be the best world that could be, because God is good. And we must just, you know, so we should try and just be happy about it, even however awful it looks to us. And Voltaire sort of writes, first of all, no, I mean, we have a right to bewail our fate and to complain about things that are not, that are painful. It's only human to do so, and rather than trying to justify it. But most importantly as well, that, you know, and this was the whole Enlightenment project was suffused with this feeling that we can try and make things better, like not try and make things perfect, but try and do little advances, whether they're technical or political or social or moral or personal, mm-hmm. to reduce the suffering where possible and to make things just, you know, that bit better. So obviously with earthquakes, you know, there's build better buildings, for example, would be one obvious way of making earthquakes less destructive to human life. And that comes across in Candide, where he, having put his characters through all sorts of terrible suffering of all kinds, he has them all gathering together and saying, Candide says, we must cultivate our garden. Mm-hmm. Slightly enigmatic remark, which I take to mean that, you know, we just should work on what we have in front of us. And there's a sense of human possibility, that it's humanly possible to slightly improve the human life, and not just human life as well, other forms of life. If we do, you know, if we do our best, if we exert ourselves, if we use all the ingenuity of which we're capable. So it's a kind of meliorist project, which is, you know, just that trying to improve on things. And, you know, it's not, I mean, the strands of the Enlightenment that are all about the use of reason. I mean, most famously, people think of the Enlightenment in terms of reason, but I think there's also a great moral interest in among Enlightenment thinkers in how we can sort of improve the level of human happiness. Yeah.
And that really, I think that is so much a part of your story, about particularly as you get into the 19th century and figures like Humboldt, and the way that we start, a way that he starts to, or the way that he articulates the meaning of an education, and has such a great influence on what we think a university is, and how we think about the education of young people. This also goes into people, the figures that you write about, like Mill. It's such a, the idea of making it possible to bring happiness to more people has become such an animating principle that influences everything from education policy and how we construct our schools, to how we think of children and how we think of children's development and developing their possibilities, mm-hmm. but also goes back to Terence and the idea that the greater diversity that we can encounter and that we can cultivate and that we can foster is such a core component of what you emphasize in linking very disparate thinkers.
It's a very 19th century hope, a very 19th century hopefulness, I think, that is in there, connected to, you know, the idea of increasing happiness or increasing human fulfillment through education, you know, particularly, but through better political systems, very great interest in freedom. I mean, this is all in the context of the Europe of the time.
Yeah.
Another figure that falls into that, I sort of look at three of them in relation to each other, is Matthew Arnold, who wrote Culture and Anarchy. He was a poet as well, wrote Culture and Anarchy. And he had this sort of belief in culture as well as education as being something that would improve us, you know, but it, but one of the things that in some ways he, there's a conservative tinge to his thinking, but one of the things that really interested me reading that book, which I've had on my shelf forever and had never actually read until I started.
Somewhere back
this
here.
I always thought of it as being probably quite a really turgid and very, very 19th century type book, but which in some ways it is very 19th century, but it's also actually quite witty in places and quite fun to read. It's but he had this very sort of egalitarian idea, really, that first of all, that you know, working class children, and he worked as an inspector of schools. That was his day job. He did it for like 30 years or something. That like working class education should not be some sort of second rate thing, with, you know, children being given second rate books or sort of pre-digested pap. You know, they should be introduced to the best. He always used the phrase, the best that's been thought or said, the best culture, the best literature, the best art, because everybody should have access to that. And he had this wonderful idea that sort of, as we advance, because he certainly had this Victorian vision of, you know, the human flourishing getting better and better, and sort of human culture getting bigger and bigger, that it's not enough to just advance yourself. You know, we should all advance together. We should all go on this sort of path together. So again, you've got that human connection. Mm-hmm. And he used, he has this sort of great passage that, you know, the whole human stream sweeping thitherward, which is apart from anything else, I love the word thitherward. It's like, you know, any excuse that I can get to use that in a sentence. I mean, you know, thither is, I've always liked thither and thence. It's kind of to there and from there, but thitherward is like in the general direction of to there. What there is not entirely clear, you know, what is this goal that he's heading for? But it just, there's this idea that we should all be, you know, sort of making human life better, having more and more access to culture.
That's a very powerful way to go back and read Arnold too. It's wonderful, and I'm with you on bringing thitherward back. So I hope everyone who's joining us can find a way to incorporate your vocabulary.
Yes, we should start we should start a campaign now. Bring back thitherward.
Yeah. We'll use that word. There's so many things I would love to talk to you about with this that I think you really accomplish in the book. And one of the things that's it's kind of amazing to me. And then I'll ask this question, and then we'll see if we have any questions from our audience. I love the way that you are able to kind of humanize the humanists, and in some cases, they're figures like Bertrand Russell, who we are these kind of monolithic figures that are very hard for us to approach in many ways. You have just this wonderful way of bringing them to life, but also they're very human figures. That's when I mentioned Forster earlier, and I used the word anti-hero, that comes through. You don't see these towering, you know, figures of thought, even though they all were. But they also, you appreciate them, and, you know, and their very human nature.
They were generally flawed because they were human beings, and human beings are flawed. So, and some of them were probably more flawed than others. You know, I mean, some of the ones that became favorites for me were sometimes the ones that were not necessarily people that I'd want to spend very much time with, because they could be difficult or obnoxious or very argumentative sometimes, or, you know, they had all sorts of things that, you know, made them less than perfect. But that's, as you say, that's in the nature of the fact that they were humanists. You know, they were humans as well, and you know, so that's right. Also, you know, I realize that the people that we've talked about, of course, tend to be all male, as well as being all European. There's some Americans in the book as well. And, you know, and I try to sort of I try to open up the wider canvas of the story, because there is so much to be said about humanism all over the world, and humanists both today and in the past, and humanist traditions and humanist ways of thinking, which mm-hmm. on the other hand, in order to keep the book to some sort of structure, I concentrated on the European tradition in those 700 years, so, because yeah. they were all sort of responding to each other. There was a, you know, it gave me just a more coherent story. But there were also some very interesting women in the book and in the story. And several of those, again, of course, human all too human, just like the men, but such yeah. compelling personalities. I mean, Mary Wollstonecraft features, for example, as a humanist as well as a feminist, because a humanist in the sense that a lot of her writing, particularly in A Vindication of the Rights of Women, written in the wake of the French Revolution and the whole idea of the rights of man, was about that same idea of sort of human unfolding, the unfolding of potential and education and development. And these are all strongly humanist strands that she's saying that women who legally as well as socially tended to be treated as children all their lives. I mean, literally, they sort of never came of age in a sense, because they were never able to completely sort of be in charge of their own property, or let alone enter politics or vote or anything like that. And she's like argued for women having better education, being able to attain a kind of what she called a moral adulthood and fulfillment, and to be able to, her phrase, unfold their faculties. So, I mean, that's an example of somebody, but something that I did in the book when I was dealing with really kind of, as you say, monolithic figures, somebody like Voltaire, you know, absolutely monolithic, yeah. is to try and just approach them through the humanist tradition, through the humanist strands in their thinking. And that was certainly the case with her. You know, it's like it makes you look at her work a little bit differently, thinking of it as humanist writing, as humanist thought. It just gives a slightly different angle, and it certainly did for me. You know, it made yeah. me think about these people in a different light.
Yeah, yeah. No, that's really interesting. I want to, we should probably see bring in some questions from the people joining us today. And this actually is a nice question, because it also is something I wanted to ask you about. Tom B says, the introducer mentioned hope. How does humanism offer hope when age after age humans are so murderous and destructive? Or is the question the answer? That is, we're still here for the moment. I guess that's so that sort of gets at both ends of it's the question that you open with, and I would ask you, you know, how you remain buoyant and optimistic, and in a time that's really, you know, that's quite challenging. It's quite challenging for everyone, and in many different directions, whether it's politics or technology or the terrible times that we've lived through over the last 100 years. So,
and just human nature. I mean, people have been feeling bad about human activity and human nature for a long, long time. This is not a recent phenomenon of sort of feeling like we are somehow so deeply flawed or so stupid or careless or bad that, you know, that there's no hope, we can't have any hope in ourselves. It seems to be just a part of our tendency to reflect on ourselves and our lives and on what it means to be a human being, and quite rightly so, because I think the darker reflections keep us honest in a way. It keeps humanist on it. I mean, you can't be optimistic all the time. You can't sort of, you know, you can't be too sunny about everything. I mean, that would be absurd. And mm-hmm. certainly when I I started the book, it's been about 6 years in the writing, I started the book in 2016, so right. you can imagine, you know, how with the events of that year, they were dramatic and you know, challenging, like as I think has continued to be the case through all the years since then. There's been many sort of challenges to an optimistic view. But I think that, to me, what I always come back to in this humanist idea of having hope in ourselves, or sort of having a kind of faith, as it were, in the better capacities of our nature. Because if we don't, if we give up on those, then it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. There really won't be any hope for us, because sinking into despair about ourselves is not going to, it's a kind of abdication of responsibility almost. I mean, I think we've created a lot of problems because of our technology, our industrialization, our enormous numbers on this planet, our, you know, sort of, I mean, no need to list all the many ways in which we've created tremendous problems and challenges. And to then sort of, for us then to say, oh, look at all these things we've done. Mm-hmm. We're terrible. And, you know, we should just abandon hope. I think it sounds very much like an abdication of responsibility. There's some wonderful, it comes up towards the end. I will actually look at this to get the quote right. There's some wonderful words by James Baldwin.
Yeah, which, I love that quote.
Which I found very sort of, you know, very much to the point here. And I would,
367.
Yeah, thank you. he said, one is responsible to life. It is the small beacon in that terrifying darkness from which we come and to which we shall return. One must negotiate this passage as nobly as possible for the sake of those who are coming after us. And I think those words have, you know, more than ever speak to us today when we're thinking about the challenges of technology, the environment, the planet, politics, war, suffering, you know, all these other things, that loss of biodiversity. You know, that's a, that's the real meaning of hope. You know, it's not a kind of sunny view that everything's going to work out fine. Mm-hmm. It's a little bit like what Voltaire was saying about all is for the best in the best of all possible worlds. That's not real hope. Real hope is, let's just, you know, see what we can do about it and try and use our better faculties, our ability to cope. We have, you wouldn't believe it always to look around, but we have quite a, actually quite an impressive ability to cooperate and collaborate amongst ourselves as a social species, and you know, technological ingenuity and many other features. But let's cultivate our garden, I suppose, would be Voltaire's way of putting it. Try to hang on. I mean, you know, I can't say I always manage to hang on to that, but I do think that there's a strong humanist message or tradition there that I think we really need.
And I think that gets to a question that Peter Stokes had, which we've talked about a little bit. He asked whether you can talk more about the anti-humanists and who the humanists are defined against. But I think we've sort of, you know, we really sort of been talking about that a little bit. Is there, and I think one of the things you talk about in the book is the fact that there's a way that anti-humanists, which you look at over the course of 7 centuries, have the great, they do a great job in keeping humanists honest and focused.
Yes. I mean, I see them as almost a kind of dance, you know, with each other between the humanist and the anti-humanist. The anti-humanist helps to remind humanists not to be too naive and you know, too optimistic, or to sort of deceive ourselves about the, you know, the bad side. The humanist, I think, reminds the anti-humanist of this sense of responsibility and this sense of looking to our own better capacities and having hope. So I can never see a future in which everybody has become 100% humanist. I think that would be bizarre. I do think that that humanism can offer a lot to more than perhaps it often gets credit for.
Linda Burke asked, and this is a bit of an open question, but what forms do you think humanism takes in today's world? Maybe I would just ask you, you close the book with the words of Robert G. Ingersoll, which is a good I mean, as you point out, humanists don't like to, it seems somewhat counterintuitive to have a creed attached to humanism, but it's probably a good way to summarize that that form.
Yeah, Robert G. Ingersoll, a 19th century humanist American, traveled around giving speeches, you know, sort of visiting places, writing articles, meeting people, spreading a, you know, very much a message that of a secular humanism, free thinking. And he himself, you know, noted that it was a bit weird to talk about having a creed, but he said that his creed, if he was to have one, could be summed up with the words, happiness is the only good. The time to be happy is now. The place to be happy is here. And the way to be happy is to make others so. So that last line is crucial. I mean, we're not talking about just being happy and everybody else can go hang. You know, this is a sense of human connection again, of our connection to other people. And I think he concluded, I mean, he delivered this creed several times, but in one of them he said something like, this creed is good enough for this world. If there turns out to be another one, then I guess I'll come up with a new creed for it. Uh-huh. But yeah, that was his creed. And I think I close the book with that. You know, I think it's, yes, in some ways it's simplistic, in some ways it doesn't capture the entire sort of meanings of humanism, but it does capture an awful lot of it. I think the idea that it's this world where we need to cultivate our garden. It's this world that we need to be happy or seek fulfillment. And mm-hmm. not just for ourselves, but in fellowship with other people.
Yeah. I think this might get to the last question that we have. It's from Abby Tunstall. She says she's aware of humanism as a European and American phenomenon. Do you know how other countries elevate the human condition through their arts and culture? Well, that's a little bit of an open-ended question, but thank you, Abby, for the question.
Thank you.
But yeah. maybe what I'll ask to direct that question just a bit is to say you acknowledge Humanists International and Humanists UK on the acknowledgements page. That's where you would acknowledge them. What's the English context? And I know that you really haven't. This is one of your first events, I think, that you've done in the U.S. Is there a different context for the reception of the word humanist in the U.K.? Can you say just a little bit about that?
I think in many ways the Anglo-American meaning of the meaning that comes first to mind, I think, as far as I am aware, in America is similar to what it is here, which is the secular meaning. That's the one that humanist organizations tend to be focused on. So it's the idea of looking for sources of both of moral purpose and meaning in life in this world's context. So in our connections with others, being part of the network of life on this planet, being ethical beings in our relationship to each other and so on, rather than looking to any kind of organized religion. Mm-hmm. The difference that I've noticed is that it's in other languages, even, you know, other European languages don't, they often do have that meaning of humanism, but it's not always the foremost one that comes to mind. You may use other terms for that. But for example, in Italy, I spend a lot of time in Italy. And mm-hmm. if you speak about umanesimo or umanisti in Italian, they tend to think mainly of the Renaissance humanists in the sense of humanities teachers. And so there's a subtle difference of emphasis. But I think, I mean, yeah, there's so much that I could say about that question, such a great question that I could go on and on. But I mean, one thing that I would like to say is that Humanists International helps to coordinate humanist organizations and humanist individuals' concerns all over the world. And in that context, it's worth noting that I think there's around 80 countries in the world where to be a humanist or to advocate humanist principles brings all sorts of dangers and potential consequences, which can range from, you know, sort of relatively minor ones, if you want to use that term, all the way up to, in some countries, the threat of the death penalty and certainly of legal penalties. So, you know, it can be dangerous to be a humanist, and there are humanists all over the world, despite those dangers. And so I mean, it's definitely not. It's in the modern world, it's definitely not a purely European American phenomenon by any means. And historically, it's not either, because I probably haven't got time to sort of go into much more detail. There is a bit in the beginning of the book. There's very strong humanist traditions in Indian philosophy, in Chinese philosophy, in African philosophy, and you know, it's a rich and very varied tradition.
It is, and I think that's one of the that's something that you you emphasize at the beginning of the book, and then we feel that pressure, that sort of almost globalization of all these. I mean, you feel these mini strands coming together throughout the rest of the book as well, and I think that's an important point to make. And I've really enjoyed our conversation. I think we're just about time, unless anyone else has any additional questions. I see there are two. I'm sorry. Let me just quickly ask two questions. I didn't see these. I'm sorry. They were underneath the fold, so to speak. Warner Q says, I love this book and can't wait to read your other works. Like you, I was particularly keen on Lorenzo Valla. Could you tell a bit of his story and why you're so enamored of him? Unfortunately, you've got 2 minutes to do that.
Lorenzo Valla in 2 minutes.
I also add the other question, and we can come back to, like, this is going to be a speed dating question. Was that Zora Neale Hurston on the cover? Wonderful. If so, how does she fit into the story? Thank you. I apologize. I did not see that there were additional questions underneath the ones that were on my screen. I would have loved to have presented this here. So,
well, since we've got 2 minutes, I think possibly, much as I would love to go on about Lorenzo Valla, possibly I should sort of leave that, because it does take a little while to explain, you know, how he fits into the story.
But it is really good. It's really fun to read.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's so much to talk about there, and yeah, I do hope that you know, people will enjoy reading about him, as I certainly did enjoy reading about him. So Zora Neale Hurston she particularly features for she had these sort of this wonderful way of talking about the sense of not expecting a personal afterlife and yet feeling connected to the whole universe through, you know, just being alive, being on this planet, being matter. And this is actually a very ancient philosophical tradition going back to, it certainly goes back to those Indian philosophies that I mentioned, which are very ancient, materialist in a way, but also very spiritual, and some ancient Greek philosophers that I probably haven't got time to go into. But there's this idea that although, you know, we're basically material, and yet, you know, through that we live on, we're connected to everything else. That actually takes us neatly back to the idea of connection again. And perhaps that makes a good point to wrap it up. Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. And my apologies to Warner and Arnie. I just didn't see your questions, and they're really wonderful points that you made. I've enjoyed this so much, and congratulations.
Me too.
It's such a wonderful book, and I'm really just so happy to be able to talk to you about it for a little bit this afternoon and evening for you. And thank you so much, and thank you everyone who joined us this afternoon.
Yes, and from me too. Thank you very much to everyone for joining us. It's been a real pleasure. Thank you very much, Eric. And
my pleasure.
Yes, have a good evening.
Good. Thank you, and hope to see you soon. Bye bye.
Bye.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.